Chapter 5. Character Inspiration, Inside Out. Quote, "To project yourself into the consciousness of a person essentially your opposite requires the audacity of great genius." Unquote. Henry James. The second grand source of inspiration places the writer not at the center of her universe, but at the heart of her character's universe. An adventurous writer brings her creation to life by imagining her way into the character's inner self, seeing through his eyes, hearing with his ears, sensing everything he senses. She envisions the character's conflicts, improvises choices, and takes moment-by-moment actions as if the character's fictional life were happening to her. This leap from one consciousness into another requires, as Henry James noted, a certain genius. I call this technique writing in character. As the in-character writer inhabits a role's inner self, his emotions become hers. Her pulse pounds with him. His anger flares inside her. She celebrates his triumphs. She loves his loves. The most powerful inspirations of all strike when the writer experiences what the character experiences. In other words, the character's first actor is the writer. An author is an improvisationalist. She first imagines herself at the pinpoint center of her character's consciousness. Once in character, her mind, emotions, and energies drive character creation. She paces the floor, arms waving, words flying, acting out her creation's man, woman, child, monster. The writer, like an actor, lives inside of her character's senses, seeing and hearing the story's events as if she were the living character herself, so that what happens in the character happens in her. How does a writer get in character? How does she improvise the character she's creating? How does she use her own emotions to give life to a fictional being? Once again, she calls on Stanislavski's magic if. In an effort to give her character life, the writer could ask, "If I were in this situation, what would I do?" That thought would certainly get juices flowing. But the writer is not the character. So what the writer might say or do in that moment may be nothing like the actions the character would take. Or the writer could ask, "If my character were in this situation, what would my character do?" But that thought sits the writer in an audience, as it were, picturing the character on stage. Rather than feeling what the character feels, the writer must now guess at his emotions. And guesses are almost always clichés. To get in character, therefore, the writer puts the magic if to work with this thought. If I were this character, in this situation, what would I do? In other words, the writer acts the scene, not as herself, but as the character. Now the character's emotions flow, not the writer's. Writing in character means more than thinking about what goes on inside a character's head. It means living within him, so that your mind occupies his mind. His self-awareness becomes yours, and you too act as one. Mastery of the inside-out technique brings characters to life on page, stage, and screen with a truthfulness and subtlety that cannot be achieved any other way. Discovering the inspirations that can be found only inside a fictional being calls for sustained, willful, and often courageous imaginings. The prerequisite for this feat is insight into your own inner life. The more you understand your true nature, the better you perceive your character's complexities. To know yourself, you must recognize your rock-bottom inner self. Compare your dreams to reality, your desires to morality, and from that base, explore the social, personal, private, and hidden selves that complete your multifaceted humanity. Your truth will become the truth of every character you create. So, before you attempt the in-character technique, let's look inside the multi-layered complexity of a human being. The observer and the observed. The brain consists of roughly 100 billion neurons laced into 100 trillion interconnections. This immense beyond imagining complexity constantly adapts and changes as it interacts with its body, and then through its body with the surrounding physical and social worlds. With every passing day, the brain evolves new thoughts and new feelings, and then stores them in memory as preparation for the future. Somehow, and science is yet to discover how, consciousness ascends out of this vast conformance, a mind that is not just aware of things around it, but is self-aware. A mind that can step back from itself and see itself as an object. The nature of the inner self has been debated for centuries. Is it real or a fantasy? Does a mind staring at itself see itself, or mirror images reflecting into infinity? Buddha, as we noticed, believed that the self is illusionary because what's inside our minds began as sensory impressions of sights and sounds from outside our minds. What we call the self is actually a bundle of external imprints that appear one after another, like an actor coming and going on and off stage. Therefore, a true self does not exist. It's a anatta, non-self, a sort of mental special effect. Socrates reversed this. He believed that not only do human beings have a solid inner realm, but two selves living within it, the observer and the observed. The core self, the observer, is the epicenter of consciousness that watches life go by and tries to understand it. The core self sends the agent self, the observed, into the world to take action. The core self then perceives its agent self in action and becomes an audience to its own daily life. This is self-awareness, the performance in your inner theater that no one attends but you. Consider this. After doing something foolish, don't you often think the thought, "You idiot"? When you do, who exactly is shaming who? When you manage a success, you often think, "I got that right." Who is patting whose back? How do self-criticism and self-congratulation work? Who talks to whom? As you listen to my words, an observing awareness within you follows your every move. You perceive, watch yourself, listen, and then act. Take notes on paper or store them in memory. This pivot from awareness to action to awareness within the mind separates the core self from the agent self. Some neuroscientists, however, to this day, still side with Buddhism. They argue that because each region of the brain has a separate function, and because no single region in and of itself causes self-awareness, a core self does not exist. Others agree with Socrates. Human beings have motor neurons for movement, sensory neurons for the senses, and interneurons, by far the most numerous, for the heavy lifting of thought. The brain, with its residue of past experiences and imaginings of future happenings, coupled with the body's nervous system and the totality of its moment-by-moment sensory encounters, focuses billions of impulses toward the center of awareness, the core self. Self-awareness, therefore, is the side effect of all the neurons in all these regions working in concert. That's why damage to one region of the brain diminishes or extinguishes the sense of self. Peak self-awareness, watching and doing, radiates through the well-nourished brain of a healthy body. This is nothing new. The Egyptians saw the observing self as a protective spirit and named it the Ba soul. The Greeks called it the daemon. The Romans dubbed it the genius. But if at the end of the day, science decides that the self is a fiction, as Buddha claimed, fine with me. Then it's our fiction, our nature, what makes us human. Try this. Go to a mirror and glance into your eyes. For an instant, you'll sense someone else deep within looking back. With the next blink, however, you'll realize that what you glimpsed was a split-second image of your core self observing you just before your agent self reacted. These moments happen best when unplanned, but it's worth a test. To deepen our understanding of human nature, we must not only accept the idea of the self, but of a caste of selves, the core self, the observer, the agent self, the observed, plus all the personal and social personae an agent self assumes, all the past selves the core self remembers, and finally, at the deepest level, the hidden self. Four selves in search of a character. To imagine how each layer of self creates a fully human character, start at the conscious center, the private realm in which the core self copes with inner dilemmas, makes decisions, then directs the agent self to take action. Next, surround that center with two outer strata. The personal realm, in which the agent self assumes various personae as it deals with intimate relationships, and the social realm, in which the agent self takes on its public personae as it copes with institutions and individuals. Finally, underpin these three levels with a substrata, the subconscious realm, in which the hidden self struggles with contradictory desires. From story to story, how many of these levels are at play in your characters is up to you. But let's work through them, one at a time. The private selves, variations of identity. William James gave the core self names such as self of selves, the owner self, the proprietor self. In his analogy, the core self is a sanctuary within a citadel, the epicenter inside our personal and public personae. James's concept of the stream of thought inspired fiction writers like Virginia Woolf to create the literary style of stream of consciousness. In the William James view of the private realm, the core self maintains a single identity over a lifetime while observing and absorbing its many past selves. We know we are not the same person we used to be, and yet we feel that we are, and always have been, our core self. Our mind has a permanent, unchanging, stable sense of identity, and yet, simultaneously, its continuously evolving consciousness acts and reacts, learns and forgets, evolves and devolves, keeps some attitudes about values and desires, but changes to others about what's worth doing, what's a waste of time, and the like. Day in, day out, we live in a natural state of paradox. We change while we stay the same. An aside here. William James's younger brother was the author Henry James. The two delved into the nature of thought in both science and fiction. Their work inspired Henry to explore the point of view techniques that revolutionized the modern psychological novel. The 19th century gave America two sets of James brothers, Henry and William, writers and psychologists, and Jesse and Frank, bank robbers and committers of atrocities. Imprisoned inside our skull, the core self lives essentially alone. Our inner voice is the only inner voice we will ever hear. Because our core self cannot contact another person's private realm telepathically, consciousness becomes a kind of cinema of the mind. Somewhere inside our head, we sit in a permanent state of isolation. An audience of one in a multi-sensational 360-degree movie that cross-cuts images from our eyes and our imagination, accompanied by sounds, smells, touches, tastes, feelings, and emotions. Someone in a deep meditative state may try to face herself within herself. She may turn away from the focal point of her meditation and look back toward her awareness, hoping that her watching self and her acting self will meet. But try as she might, the two never do, never can. For the moment consciousness focuses on the next thing, the core self steps back to observe. This is the Hamlet dilemma. Hamlet's mind, like two mirrors facing each other, stares at itself throughout the play. As he strives to understand himself, he becomes obsessed with his consciousness of his own consciousness. He tries to step inside self-awareness and study himself from within, but cannot. Finally, after the graveyard scene in Act 5, Hamlet discovers that his life has been a quest with no object except his endlessly burgeoning subjectivity. When at last he purges himself of his obsession with himself, he finds peace of mind. As Hamlet discovers, you cannot face yourself within yourself. You know you're there, but you cannot separate your core self from the rest of your mind and hold it out and look at it. When you turn toward it, it just shifts behind you once again, blocking the gateway to the subconscious. If you could actually squeeze behind your core self, you would fall into a swirling, subliminal abyss. When a character talks about herself in a first-person novel, or in soliloquy on stage, or in voiceover narration on screen, the self receiving criticism is usually referred to as you, as in, you fool, while the self hearing praise is addressed as I, as in, I got that right. Shakespeare uses I in soliloquies because his characters talk to the audience, not themselves. Nonetheless, some actors play soliloquies as if they were duologues of core self versus agent self, an argument within a split personality. When the mind decides to take action, the core self sends its agent self into the world and watches what happens. The public performances of the agent self are called by various names: personalities, personae, masks, fronts, poses, and the like. All apt synonyms, but I prefer the term selves. When writing in character, the writer needs to see her character's behaviors for what they are: impersonations of the core self. So, while staying constantly observing, the writer, as first actor, also becomes an agent self to improvise these performances. The core self may undergo major variations. The extended self. Henry and William James stretch the core self into the extended self. In their view, a person's identity includes all things mine. Her computer extends her mind, her iPhone extends her reach, her car, her legs, her clothes, her skin, as do, each in their own way, her friends and ancestors, education and profession, taste in vacations, music, movies, and how she looks in the gym mirror. The sum total of all things she calls her own creates her total sense of self. As a result, she feels about her things very much the way she feels about herself. To lose a job, a loved one, or her good looks is to lose a piece of herself. If a friend, lover, or family member does something wrong, she feels ashamed. If they are insulted, she flashes with anger. If they prosper, so does she. If they dwindle, so does she. Although many people feel that coupling one's identity to things, even other people, hints of moral weakness, it's what human beings do. The protected self. The core self, for sanity's sake, must keep its secrets. As Michel de Montaigne put it, we must reserve a little back shop all our own, entirely free, wherein we maintain our retreat, liberty, and precious solitude. All authors, especially prose writers, look in this little back shop for a voice that's strong enough to narrate a first-person novel or short story. This protected, sane self contains a set of enduring faculties: willpower, rational thought, and moral sensibility. The vanished self. However, when a character comes under extreme stress due to disasters such as physical injury, sudden poverty, drug dependency, insanity, senility, terminal illness, and the like, these derangements attack the core self, causing overpowering emotions, paralyzing thought, seizures, hallucinations, amnesia, lapses of consciousness, or splits, or even reversals of personality. In a word, a character de-dimensionalizes. Her identity weakens, she becomes unmoored, alone, until her essential self eventually vanishes. Examples? In Ken Kesley's novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Chief Bromden, a patient in an insane asylum, tells his tale while plagued with schizophrenic hallucinations. In Forbidden Planet, a scientist's research releases a monster from his id. In Memento, the protagonist battles anterograde amnesia and short-term memory loss. In Will Self's novel, Phone, psychiatrist Zachary Boosner copes with the onset of Alzheimer's. In Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude, Jose Buendia loses his memory, so he marks everything around him with its name: chair, clock, door, and so on. In Eugene Ionesco's play, Exit the king's mind, horrified by his pending death, splinters like a windshield in a head-on collision. When a loss of self causes radical change in a character's perception of reality, the writer's talent must rise to the occasion. Now, the magic if becomes, if I were this character under these extreme circumstances, what would I do? To take the point of view of a distorted core self, you must imagine its altered reality and invent its coping strategies, as disturbing as they may be. Because a character's sense of I depends on memory, and memory is notoriously selective, protective, self-deceptive, and prone to self-justifications, the core self and the agent self often have a fallible, illusionary kinship. The core self of certain characters wavers, constantly reinventing itself as it pushes through life. To express that splintering, Joyce Carol Oates, in her novel Blonde, fragmented Marilyn Monroe into numerous selves. Personal selves, variations of intimacy. When we encounter other people, we attune our behavior to the quality of that relationship. We do not treat our mother, for example, the way we treat our sister. We do not treat our current lover the way we treat an ex. We do not treat our best friend the way we treat a coworker. Our agent self adopts timbre of voice, gestures, facial expressions, and emotional energies geared to the relationship's length of acquaintance, balance of power, current history, and many other variables. The changes may be subtle, but they're always in play. Personal relationships are defined by degrees of intimacy and come in three textures: family, friends, lovers. In the first two, feelings of closeness, belonging, loyalty, and bonding develop through shared experiences, some painful, some pleasurable, that stay secret inside the relationship. Lovers add romantic rituals and sexuality. We adapt our behaviors, but that doesn't falsify us. Common sense tells us that diverse interactions call for diverse selves. Indeed, the more relationships a character has, the more versions of her the in-character writer must invent and perform. Compared to the core self, personal selves are temporary behaviors, easily dropped as an agent self moves from scene to scene. A character's most important and hopefully consistent personal self is the one loved by her loved ones. Social selves, variations of power. Power is the primary shaper of social interactions, whether it's projected financially, physically, or from inside an institution's hierarchy. Boss versus employee, cop versus criminal, server versus served. From her earliest childhood, your protagonist, while squeezing her mother's hand as she was dragged through shopping malls or coping with other kids on her first day of school, learned the need for social masks, for tactics to avoid friction, and yet get what she wants. All social selves are insincere to a degree and yet necessary to protect the core self. So, no matter what your character actually thinks or feels about the people around her, her agent self has developed the social persona that she shows her boss, others for her coworkers, yet more masks to wear for duets such as clerk-customer, doctor-patient, lawyer-client, as well as multiple happenstances in classrooms, at political protests, during sporting events, and a very special variation for schmoozing from clique to clique at a party. So depending on factors such as familiarity and status, her social selves operate with a variety of voices, gestures, attitudes, and aspects of personality that she has invented so she can shift gears from encounter to encounter. She may, for example, play the dominant self with one person, the submissive with another. Lena Wertmüller's film Swept Away gave us the wealthy matron Raffaella Mariangela Melato as a delightful example of this flip. A character's selves, both personal and social, are best thought of as sets of performances. Each role has a particular tone of voice, eye expression, body language, and nervosity, depending on the identity of the other person and the quality of power or intimacy between them. How a writer develops her character's personal and social selves depends on her theory of psychological cause and effect. Do the social and personal roles her character learns between childhood and adulthood combine to build her core self? Or does her core self design the roles she plays from encounter to encounter? Does a child's role playing solidify into an adult's core self that then redirects her future role-playing toward more mature performances? Or does she stay forever a child, always at the mercy of her impulsive, reckless self? The identity a character inherits from her parents, race, religion, culture, gives her common ground with her society. Over time, however, it's what makes her different that evolves and reshapes her identity. Difference is the centrifugal force that throws people into the world, searching for a subculture that fits them and fellow travelers that befriend them. How, for example, does a transgender child trapped in a zealously orthodox religion successfully navigate her public life? How can she evolve her social and personal selves so she finally fits in? The Hidden Self, Variations of Desire. Quote, "There's someone in my head, but it's not me." That was Pink Floyd paraphrasing Carl Jung. The subconscious self sits in the silent space behind the conscious mind. This realm is complex and structurally sophisticated. Although it stays hidden from the core self, perceptions and feelings flow back and forth between them, each influencing the other. The subconscious is neither a refuge nor a medic for a wounded identity. Anchored in the truth, it never lies, never pretends. Instead, it obeys one imperative: survive. Although mute, the subconscious thinks far faster than the core self realizes. It absorbs millions of sensory stimuli per minute as it sizes up an environment, and then enhances mental efficiency by making immediate decisions and performing countless rote tasks, leaving the core self free to react to the unfamiliar. The subconscious contains moods and feelings, automatic skills, automatic reactions, unperceived perceptions, habits, phobias, dreams, memories, implicit knowledge, and sudden creative insights. Innate desires arise out of this hidden self, cravings for food, sex, and survival at all costs, as well as for knowledge, love, and peace. Because these drives would disrupt the conscious mind, they stay out of view. Nonetheless, they sway judgments, feelings, and behavior. The question, therefore, becomes, can an author working in character improvise from within the role's subconscious mind? We inherited our subconscious from our tree-dwelling ancestors. Like the mind of an animal, it has neither language nor self-awareness, thus making thought, in the usual sense, seemingly impossible. On the other hand, I've often imagined desires and curiosities raging inside my pets, so I don't see why not. If it helps bring your characters to life, try it. Mad Men. Four Selves in Action. To script the long-form series Mad Men, showrunner Matthew Weiner and his co-writers developed each character at three levels of conflict: their work life, intimate life, and secret life. These levels correspond to the social self, personal self, and core self. I've added a fourth level, the subconscious life, so that the interpretations that follow include each character's hidden self. Human nature is an unsolved mystery of elegant, glorious confusion. The four-self structure frames character creation, but it's not a set of instructions. The creation of major characters, whether inside out or outside in, should ultimately give you insight into their natures at all four levels of self. Study the following cast members and compare their four-level designs to the roles in your current writings. Don Draper, played by John Hamm. Social self, smooth-talking ad agency creative director with a genius for seducing clients. Personal self, his wife and two children seem like a picture-perfect family in a breakfast cereal commercial, but Don's extramarital affairs corrupt and destroy that illusion. Core self. Don's real name is Dick Whitman. He stole his Draper identity from a dead officer during the Korean War. As a result, his guilt-ridden conscience renders him incapable of love, and he knows it. Hidden self. He's haunted by a sense of dread. Despite his great success, he fears his life is meaningless and will come to nothing. Betty Draper, played by January Jones. Social self. Betty, a college-educated former model, spends her time squabbling with her children, horseback riding, and chain smoking. Personal self, pregnant with a third child she doesn't want, Betty feels trapped in an empty marriage. Core self. She takes revenge on her unfaithful husband by using her sexual charms to torment a neighbor's young son and indulge in one-night stands with anonymous men. Hidden self. Gnawing self-doubt tells her she's lucky she was born beautiful, because otherwise she'd be ordinary. Roger Sterling, played by John Slattery. Social self, Roger, partner and rainmaker for the firm, suffers two heart attacks. Personal self, he wants to divorce his wife, but can't decide which of his mistresses, if any, he actually loves. Core self. Roger pines for the voluptuous Joan, but can't admit it. Hidden self. His greatest fear is being alone. Peggy Olson, played by Elizabeth Moss. Social self. By dint of IQ and willpower, Peggy works her way up from secretary to copywriter, landing her own office and secretary. Personal self. Peggy, a devout Catholic, pursues her career against pressure from her marriage-minded family. Core self. Peggy hides her secret pregnancy by letting others think she's just gaining weight. Hidden self. She's the smartest person in the room and tempted by strange sexual impulses she can't admit to herself. Pete Campbell, played by Vincent Kartheiser. Social self. Pete, a young executive, engineers power games as he climbs the corporate pyramid. Personal self. Because his wife desperately wants a child but cannot conceive, Pete can never find balance in his marriage. Core self. On his wedding eve, Pete slept with Peggy Olson, and she later gave birth to his son. He longs for the child he'll never know. Hidden self. He's talentless, but doesn't let that truth get in his way. Joan Holloway, played by Christina Hendricks. Social self. Joan's stunning looks camouflage her brainy insights into people. Personal self. Her loveless marriage to an incompetent doctor leads to an illegitimate child and divorce. Core self. She deceives herself into thinking that marriage gives a woman's life meaning, thus denying her business prowess. Hidden self. She's a loner who doesn't want to work for anyone but herself. Sal Romano, played by Brian Bat. Social self. Sal, the agency's art director, illustrates Don's snappy slogans. Personal self. He's married, but without children. Core self. Sal desperately hides his homosexuality from his homophobic colleagues. Hidden self. He hates being gay. Outside in, inside out. The technique of writing in character links the artist's creative self to the character's inner life, but few writers work exclusively from the inside out. Rather, they take a double path, alternating between perspectives. First, they gather clues to the character's identity from the outer shells of her setting and society, as well as from her age, IQ, and genetic givens. Then they peer down through the various levels of behavior to her core, instinctive self. The magic if puts them in character, and from there they improvise. But even while in character, they often alternate points of view from character to character. For example, if a writer were sketching a scene between characters A and B, she would find a true-to-character choice in action by asking the question, if I were character A at this moment, what would I do? Then, in the next beat, she would switch point of view and ask, if I were character B in this situation, how would I react to what character A just said and did? Each time the writer steps out of character, she reflects on the actions and reactions just created and the effects they caused on both roles. Her thoughts and feelings shift from inside to out, then outside to in, subjective to objective, objective to subjective, repeating these cycles until the scene is perfected. E. L. Doctorow, a superb practitioner of this alternating technique, worked both ends against the middle. In his historical fictions, such as Ragtime and The Waterworks, he researched his subject until he was a world-class authority on it, but then, as he acted out his characters, he gave them guises. Doctorow's fictional characters often seem as if they were historical personages, while his historical figures seem as if they had been improvised in his ingenious brain.